Catholic Answers Live, Edgar Lujano once again filling in for Cy Kellett. If you've ever called into the show, you're normally talking to me as a call screener, but today we have me hosting and Jordan call screening. So thank you, Jordan, for covering that. I appreciate it. All right, so today's second hour, we have Jim Blackburn. He is the founder and president of Catholic Questions, which I would assume is, it works pretty close to what we do here at Catholic Answers. Right, Jim?
It does. In fact, when I was at Catholic Answers, there was a Q&A department. And for almost 10 years, I was the supervisor of that department. And in that department, we would take one-on-one questions anytime, you know, during the business hours. People could call in, email, whatever. And we had a staff of apologists who would answer those questions, get back to the person with an answer and maybe some additional resources. Now, as Catholic Answers has grown and the focus has become more on the speakers and the School of Apologetics and the conference and those kinds of things where you have much larger audiences, eventually Catholic Answers couldn't sustain the Q&A department anymore. So when Catholic Answers ended that, shortly after that, I started Catholic Questions. So we've kind of picked up that area of, you know, one-on-one answering questions, Q&A apologetics. And we've been doing it for 2.5 years now. And it started out as kind of a temporary thing just to Christmas time to during the holiday season to see if how it would catch on. And people wanted us to continue it. And still today, we're going four apologists. I have plus me, so five of us altogether now. We're all volunteers, but it's a full-time venture for me, and we answer as many questions as we can. We answer every question we get, and it takes us, once in a while, we'll get to some questions on the same day, but it's usually the next day, possibly 2 days later. So you can't get quite the instant feedback you get here on Catholic Answers Live, but nonetheless, it's a venue to get your questions answered. So, okay. Yeah, it's the website is catholicquestions.com. We have, you can ask your question right from there. You can email us also. You can call us. You can write us a letter. And we also have apps for both the Android phones and for iPhones and iPads and just about anything that has apps from the Google Play Store or the Apple Store.
Great.
Any way you wanted to ask a question, we're trying to make it available to you.
Great. So you can also do kind of text kind of thing. So you're texting your friend about Catholicism. Is that kind of one of the means you can do it?
Yeah, we don't have a texting set up yet, although that's something we've talked about. But it's more we're going to get back to you by email. So we need an email address. However you're going to ask your question, if it's through the apps or through the online venue, we need an email address from you, and that's how we're going to respond.
Gotcha. All right, great. Well, there's plenty of Catholic questions on the line. If you want to go ahead and get to them, we can provide Catholic answers. How about, what
sure,
do you say?
Sure, let's do that.
All right, great. Let's go ahead and start off with Gregory calling from Santa Clarita, California. Gregory, go right ahead with your question.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. Thank you for taking my call. So I have a question related to, or a couple questions related to the Divine Mercy devotion. I'm an enthusiast. I love it. It's changed my life. But I get grief from both sides of the Catholic spectrum on it, and I have some questions. On one side, from progressive friends, I'm told that St. Faustina was an anti-Semite and that that shouldn't be the practice. And on the more traditional spectrum, I get demonic, horrible, reject modernity. And I understand that there's a history with the devotion, and it was suppressed for a time, or whatever the right term is, but people have been practicing it for a long time. So my question is this: why are people still not liking it now? Why is it okay? And how do I deal with these people when they're pushing back against my involvement with the devotion?
Okay. Well, let me preface this by saying, let's see, it's Gregory, right? By saying that no one is obligated to have or embrace any particular devotion that the church offers. So it's okay for someone to say, I don't want to you know, do the Divine Mercy Chaplet. I don't want the indulgence on Divine Mercy Sunday, you know, these kinds of things. If a person chooses not to have the divine, to embrace the Divine Mercy devotion, that's okay. It's not required by the faith. Now, on the other hand, Pope John Paul II was very much into the Divine Mercy devotion. He, in fact, really promulgated a lot of, with Divine Mercy Sunday and the indulgence for divine, on Divine Mercy Sunday, these kinds of things. Pope John Paul II was very active with this devotion, and he really promoted it a lot. So we have a lot of people today who are very much into that devotion. They do embrace it quite a bit. I would say for anyone who does not, and you know, if you're trying to convince someone that you found it to be very helpful to you and you really think someone else should, especially if it's someone who has problems with it, then you might encourage them to read Pope John Paul II's writings on the Divine Mercy Sunday, on just Divine Mercy itself, as well as on the devotion and Divine Mercy Sunday. You can find that he has an encyclical on Divine Mercy. Encourage them to read those things. But if they still choose not to, I mean, that there's nothing opposed to the faith in the idea of the of Divine Mercy Sunday and the Divine Mercy devotion. A person doesn't have to, let's say, have a devotion to St. Faustina to embrace the Divine Mercy devotion itself. So you might make a separation there as well, Gregory. You know, beyond that, I wouldn't push people too hard on it. There are people who embrace the other devotions and prefer not to embrace this one. That's okay. We can't all do every one of the devotions that are out there. And so don't treat it as though it's a matter of faith that they have to embrace the devotion itself. Certainly the teaching of Divine Mercy, of God's Divine Mercy, is something that must be embraced. But the devotion, the particular devotion of Divine Mercy, is not something that anyone has to. Okay, Gregory?
I think I may have asked the question wrong. I'm not pushing it on anyone. I'm being told it's problematic that I'm doing it.
Okay, and what are they saying the problem is? So, you mentioned they have a problem with St. Faustina.
Right, so just historically, it's the press. We're not supposed to do it. It takes away from the Sacred Heart. She, on the other side of the equation, she was an anti-Semite, so don't do it. And so that's really the issue. I'm a live and let live. Like, do whatever devotion you want to do, but why am I being attacked because I have a devotion to it and I have a connection to it? So that's really what I'm asking about.
Okay, well, you might respond to that with the fact that St. Faustina has been canonized as saint in the Catholic Church. And so it could be that some of the problems people have with St. Faustina, these people you're talking to, might misunderstand her. Maybe they misunderstand some of her writings. So you might go down that road by talking about what specifically is the problem with their particular problems with St. Faustina, and then and go from there. But this is kind of a one-on-one thing, Gregory. You might contact us at Catholic Questions off the air, and give us some more specifics. Once you go back and forth with someone, get them to pinpoint exactly what it is, why it is they think you are doing something wrong. And if they think because the Divine Mercy devotion is associated with St. Faustina, maybe they don't have a problem with the devotion itself, but they have a problem with St. Faustina, then let's talk about that, and we'll try to help you with that. We can look back at the canonization process for her, show that to the challengers, and see how they respond to that. I wouldn't question the fact that she's a saint. I mean, this is really an infallible declaration. We know that she's in heaven, so whatever. In fact, any saint we look at might have a history of something. We're all sinners before we're saints, and Saint Faustina is no exception to that. So there may be some things in her past that a person might have difficulty with, but we can look at how she overcame those and through the grace of God and with the church. And so we should not hold that against her anymore if God's not holding that against her anymore. You know, we can have an approach like that. So contact me, Gregory. Just go to CatholicQuestions.com and send me a message there. And maybe wait to do that until you've had this conversation. And just broad challenges are not good enough. Let's try to pinpoint what it is they specifically have a problem with. And then we'll pick it up from there and try to help you with that.
Perfect. Thank you so much for taking my call. This was helpful.
Okay.
All right. I will send you an email.
You're welcome.
All right. Thank you, Gregory, for that call. Let's go ahead and go on our first break for the hour. If you have a question, there's one line open. You can give us a call at 888-318-7884. That's 888-318-7884. And we'll be right back after this break.
Let us help you with your question today on Catholic Answers Live.
Do you have a question but prefer to ask it privately? Catholic Questions can help. Go to CatholicQuestions.com to ask your question online, email us, drop us a letter, or give us a call. Longtime Catholic Answers Live apologist and author Jim Blackburn or another Catholic Questions apologist will be happy to assist you. Catholic Questions proudly supports Catholic Answers Live, so visit us at CatholicQuestions.com today. That's CatholicQuestions.com.
This is Bernadette Boguski, Executive Director of WCCR Cleveland, AM 1260 The Rock. Why do we need Catholic radio? To reach the hearts, minds, and souls of those who are searching for deeper meaning and don't know where to turn. To bring clarity to a world full of lies and confusion. And to share the good news of joy and mercy with a world so desperate for the truth.
The world needs EWTN Catholic Radio. Now, more than ever.
Catholic Answers Live, Edgar Lujano, radio and podcast producer here at Catholic Answers. And I guess since I am the podcast producer, I should really promote the podcast. Why not? So if you are a podcast buff, you can listen to any of our podcasts at CatholicAnswersPodcast.com. Anything from this live show to Catholic Answers Focus, Council of Trent, the Trent Horn, not the actual council. You also have Shameless Popery with Joe Heschmeyer. Sunday Catholic Word with Carlo Broussard, and of course the Daily Defense with Jimmy Akin. So plenty of podcasts for anybody, from going into deep dives with Joe, or just taking about 3 minutes with Jimmy Akin. So, all right. On that note, Jim, shall we continue with the phones?
Yeah, let's go.
All right, great. We're going to move on with going to Cam, listening from Dallas, Texas. Cam, go right ahead with your question.
Hello.
Hi, Cam.
Thank you for taking my call. So my question is simply, why does the Vatican allow for the canonization of non-Catholic saints? Example, St. Gregory Palamas is venerated in the Eastern Catholic churches. He was, I believe, an Orthodox monk. So this has been very puzzling to me. I understand that many of the Eastern Catholic churches were formerly Orthodox and then came into communion with Rome. I'm pretty new to the faith, so if I'm wrong, please correct me. But this sure. is just simply, it's weird to me, especially in regards to salvation and how it relates to non-Catholics. So that's my question.
Okay, Cam, let me ask you something then. Do you believe that a non-Catholic can go to heaven?
I don't know. I've read
okay.
the catechism. I have a copy of the Catechism of the Catholic Church, and I've been reading through it, and what I've been getting from the book is there is little to no salvation outside of the Catholic Church. Like I said, new to the faith. Please forgive me.
Okay.
But yeah, that's my answer.
Sorry to put you on the spot there, but I think that the important thing to recognize here is that the Church does recognize that all salvation comes through Christ, through the Catholic Church, but it's possible for those outside the Catholic Church to be saved, but they will still be saved through Christ and through the Catholic Church. Now, the Eastern Orthodox churches are extremely close to Catholicism in their faith. You know, they have valid apostolic succession. They have the same seven sacraments we have. There's very little that separates Eastern Orthodoxy from Catholicism. Now, St. Gregory Palamas, to my knowledge, he's never been canonized as saint by the Catholic Church. I believe he was canonized in the Eastern Orthodox churches. That doesn't mean that we as Catholics can't believe he is a saint. In fact, because we know that there can be salvation for someone who is an Eastern Orthodox monk, as you mentioned, or even Protestant, or even a non-Christian. It's possible for salvation. Now, we're probably not going to recognize ever someone who's not a Christian as a saint. It would take a lot for the church to ever do that. But certainly someone who is of an Eastern Orthodox tradition, very close, very little separates from Catholicism. If this person has, there has been evidence, say, for this person's sainthood, we can recognize that as Catholics. Now, as I mentioned, St. Gregory Palamas, I'm not certain that he's ever been officially recognized as a saint in the Catholic Church or declared a saint, but I do know there is some devotion to him, and that's perfectly fine for Catholics to believe that he is a saint. When our brothers in the Eastern Orthodox churches recognize him as a saint, that's right there a pretty good start. So, Cam, I would encourage you to go to the Catechism of the Catholic Church, where it talks about, and this is in the paragraph 800s, roughly, the four marks of the Church. So it's one, Holy, Catholic, and Apostolic Church. And when it talks about Catholic, the Church mentions in there, the Catechism mentions that while there is no salvation outside the Catholic Church, it looks at this doctrine, this teaching of the Church, that there is no salvation outside the Catholic Church. And the Catechism explains that in Vatican II, this teaching was reformulated in a positive way. Now, it's the same teaching. It's always been there. But instead of making it sound so negative, the Church reformulated it in a positive way. And instead of saying there is no salvation outside the Catholic Church, it now says, you'll read this in the Catechism, that all salvation comes through Christ through the Catholic Church. After that paragraph, it goes on to mention that there are elements of salvation, or God uses other churches, other communities, other faiths in some ways to bring the people closer to Him. And God can work with these people. And if a person dies in the grace of God, he's lived his life according to the grace he's received, and he's responded to it well, he dies in a state of grace, that person too may be saved. He will still be saved through the Catholic Church, through Christ, but he may not have been recognized as a Catholic in this life. So it's important to recognize that, and I think that will get you over the hump of recognizing why St. Gregory Palamas, for example, could be someone that would be venerated by some Catholics. Okay, Cam?
Yes, that answers my question. Thank you.
All right. Okay. Thank you, Cam. Thank you for your question. You know, Jim, I was thinking about recently, I guess, a similar situation in regards to potential, or, you know, people who are in heaven and saints with Christ are the 21 Coptic martyrs that were recently recognized as martyrs by Pope Francis. So we actually have a blog post by Father Hugh Barber, not talking about the differences, but acknowledging and recognizing, though, you know, even though they are not fully part of the Catholic Church, that these men, these Coptic martyrs, were also true witnesses of Christ because of their actions. So if people are interested in reading that, it's from our Indulgences blog. Father Hugh Barber wrote it back in actually earlier this month on the 16th. So people, if you're interested in checking that out, just go to catholic.com.
I was going to say, you bring up another good point in that the church recognizes that while baptism is ordinarily necessary for salvation, God is not bound by the sacrament of baptism. He can provide the fruits, the graces of baptism, such as with martyrs. So, those people were never actually officially card-carrying Catholics. They were not baptized Catholics, and yet they died for their faith, and they are considered saints. So I just thought that was a great example.
Yeah, absolutely. And like I mentioned, if you're interested in reading that small blog post by Father Hugh Barber on our indulgences page, you can go to catholic.com, click on magazine, and you should be able to find that blog post. All right, moving on, we're going to go to Marty listening in Lincoln, Nebraska. Marty, go right ahead with your question.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. So this is from Matthew 16:18. I grew up hearing about Peter and the church and this revelation and that this Greek was Big Rock, Little Rock. That's what I grew up hearing. And as I'm older, I'm reading footnotes in a St. Joseph Study Bible, and it talks about how there's really not much difference between those two words, and that the original language was Aramaic, and the word was, I think, Kephas. I think that's how it's pronounced. And so I guess my question is, was the original Aramaic, did it also say Little Rock, Big Rock? Or I understand kind of in the Greek the masculine and feminine nouns. Mm-hmm. And I understand when you translate things, they don't always translate very well from one language to another. In fact, sometimes things don't translate at all. And could you just help me make sense of all this? I understand it's probably tied to that verse 19 that Jesus says, I'll give you the keys to the kingdom. And it would seem to me in the Greek that he's actually saying that to Peter. I will give you, Peter, the keys to the kingdom of heaven.
Yes.
Did this need help unpacking all that?
Okay. We know that Jesus, as in his common everyday language, was Aramaic. And so when he said this to St. Peter in Matthew 16, as you're quoting there, he likely said, used the word Kepha, which just means rock. There's not that distinction, as you mentioned, between Big Rock and Little Rock, or the feminine and the masculine with this. He used the word rock. So it would be like in English saying, Peter, you are a rock, and on this rock I build my church. However, when the gospel writers, when Matthew wrote his gospel, he wrote in Greek, and he had to translate that word into the Greek word. He had to transfer Kephas into Greek. And I guess the way he chose to do that was he used Petra, which is would be the feminine and for the Little Rock, say, to first name, to say that when Jesus first says rock, you are Petra. And on this rock we'll build one church. But then he uses the masculine, because he's naming Peter the rock. He's naming him rock. He calls him Petros instead of Petras, the masculine versus the feminine. So there's a difference in the Greek, and this is where we find a challenge to this sometimes. People look at this and say, you're just a little rock, and I'm going to build my church on this big rock. No, there's really not that distinction. There wouldn't be that distinction in the Aramaic. So I would recommend that you go to Catholic.com. There's a tract on this that goes through the Aramaic, goes through the Greek, and explains this and gets to the challenges a little more than we probably can here on the air. The title of the tract is Peter the Rock, and you can find that in the tract section at Catholic.com.
How's that, Marty?
Okay. That's a great answer. I really appreciate that. I will definitely look that up. Could I just make a kind of a follow-up thing that I'm thinking about?
Yeah, quickly. We're coming up on a break here, but go ahead.
Okay. I'm wondering when Matthew wrote this in Greek, or whoever put it in Greek, was it like because Peter as Pope was already established, they didn't think that would be like an issue of people confusing that?
Well, I think probably he was trying to translate rock, just rock itself, from the Aramaic, Kepha. Say, maybe he even heard Jesus say this to Peter, in the most common word that would be used for that, and that was then the Petra. But when he got to naming Peter, he had to use the masculine version, because Peter is a man. I hear the music, so we'll have to leave it at that.
Yeah, we'll leave it at that, Marty. Thank you so much. If you want to follow up, give us a call back a different day. This is Catholic Answers Live. We'll be right back.
This year, the Catholic Answers Conference turns its attention to the question of God in an age of unbelief. Join us September 21st through 24th in San Diego for I Believe in God, featuring very special guest Scott Hahn and an all-star lineup of speakers. Spend four fun days with your favorite Catholic Answers apologists. Seats are still available, but going fast. Use promo code EARLY to save $50 and register today at CatholicAnswersConference.com.
In These 12, The Gospel Through the Apostles' Eyes, best-selling author Rod Bennett gives a riveting re-examination of gospel events from the ground floor perspective of Christ's own hand-picked successors. In his trademark storytelling style, Bennett movingly depicts what it was like for the apostles to witness Jesus' teaching and miracles up close. Why did he call them, and what did he intend for them to do? Order your copy of These 12 today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Want to know more about the origins of the Catholic Church? Joe Heschmeyer explores the beginnings of Christianity. In the early church was the Catholic Church. Joe digs deep into the words and actions of those who lived right after the apostles to refute anti-Catholic claims of how the faith was lived back then. Order your copy of The Early Church Was the Catholic Church today at shop.catholic.com or get it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
If you're not a Bible scholar, the full message of how the Sunday Mass readings fit together can be tough to comprehend. Apologist Carlo Broussard is here to help. Join Carlo every Friday for the Sunday Catholic Word Podcast. In each episode, he unpacks the scripture readings for that Sunday and brings them all together so you can better understand and defend the faith. Visit SundayCatholicWord.com to subscribe. That's SundayCatholicWord.com.
Catholic Answers Live, Edgar Lujano once again filling in for the great Cy Kellett. I'm going to read a little pitch here that Carrie gave me. Are you concerned about how well equipped the young people in your life, or you for that matter, are to engage in conversations about faith with atheists, agnostics, or those who are indifferent to religion? Then this year's Catholic Answers Conference is for you and for them. Plan now on making a family trip to this year's Catholic Answers Conference, I Believe in God, from September 21st to the 24th in beautiful sunny San Diego. Many of our speakers have strong backgrounds in speaking to young people and adults about the faith, making them particularly well-suited to the task of teaching us what we need to know. Don't miss this opportunity to deepen your own faith and gain the knowledge and skills to help the young people in your life grow in theirs. Our special guests are Professor Scott Hahn, Sister Regina Marie Gorman, Dale Alquist, Dr. Francis Beckwith, and Dr. Logan Gage, plus Catholic Answers Live host Cy Kellett and all your favorite Catholic Answers apologists. This conference is expected to sell out early, so reserve your seat today by going to CatholicAnswersConference.com. And if you're looking to stay at the conference venue, we've arranged a very special room rate for about $175. Visit CatholicAnswersConference.com to make room reservations. The promo code EARLY saves you $50 off your conference ticket, plus conference tickets to make a great gift for dads and for graduates. So we hope to see you there. It's going to be a fun conference. We were able to attend it last year, and I think this year's topic is going to be just as fun. All right, Jim, shall we continue with the calls? I think all lines are full and ready to talk to you.
Yeah, let's go.
All right, great. Well, we'll go ahead with Will from Stafford, Virginia. Go right ahead with your question, Will.
Hello.
I will.
I'm asking about the... Can you hear me?
Loud and clear. Go right ahead.
I'm asking about the authority the church has in state affairs. Specifically, I'm thinking about instances in history where popes have blessed particular monarchs, like Alexander II blessed William the Conqueror when he went into England. So does the church hold that certain leaders can be, in some sense, appointed by God, like a lot of monarchs have claimed? And I'm not saying it as a bad thing. I'm just curious what the Catholic doctrine is, if that makes sense.
Okay, the first thing that comes to my mind is in Romans 13, St. Paul tells us, and I'm pulling this up now, St. Paul tells us that let every, this, I'm starting with verse 1, let every person be subject to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except from God, and those that exist have been instituted by God. Now, Paul is not talking about any particular leader, any particular politician, any particular conqueror here. He's talking about, though, in a general sense, this is how humanity works. And there are people in authority, and we should respect that authority and trust that authority in as much as it's not opposed to God. Now, anything, any law, let's say, that would contradict divine law or church law, we can't support that. But if it's not contrary to the law of the church or the law of God in general, then that's something that we should be subject to. We should pay our taxes. We should, support the government in a sense. And giving a blessing, let's say a papal blessing or a local bishop giving a blessing to the local politicians, that's a perfectly wonderful, beautiful thing. How does that will then relate to your question? Is there
That's a good
what
start,
more
I
was
guess.
There to it?
Sorry. No.
Go ahead. I just
have,
go ahead.
You have certain monarchies throughout history that claim they have some sort of mandate of heaven. If that makes sense, that the line of the monarchy has the blessing of God. Is the Catholic position that there is credence to that claim in some cases?
No. I mean, the Catholic Church doesn't go that far to say that this person is in this office because God wants that person in that office. I would say outside of the papacy. I mean, in the papacy, when we have a conclave and the bishops, the cardinals voting in the conclave, the certain guidance of the Holy Spirit, and the new pope is elected, and we believe that is by there is something divine going on there. The pope is in his office by divine appointment, in a sense, even though he's been appointed, by human beings. There's the Holy Spirit guiding this process. Outside of that, there's no guarantee of that, and the church doesn't give its blessing to anyone claiming that. The monarchies and such, we're going to pray for them. I mean, there are many people subject to the monarchs and subject to the monarchy itself. So we hope and pray that the monarchy will look out for the genuine good of the people. And so there's nothing wrong with praying for them, blessing the monarchs, the monarchy, blessing the President of the United States, blessing our governors and our politicians and praying for them. In fact, we should be doing that. Now, where we part ways with them, we want to try to change that. I had somebody ask a question recently, at Catholic Questions, is it a sin? I mean, if these people are in office because God has designed it that way, then is it a sin for us to oppose that and try to, vote them out of office or impeach them or vote for someone else to take their place? Well, that's a misunderstanding of Paul's words in Romans. It's a misunderstanding of how God acts or how the church understands that God acts in this way. The office itself is what is more of an institution of God. The person who's in that is actually... should be a person who recognizes he's to be of service, and he's to he's there by the grace of God, but he can be removed from that office. And inasmuch as he opposes God or he opposes truth, or he opposes the teaching of the church, we can work to get that person out of that office. So I hope that helps, Will.
Okay, yeah, thank you. That all makes sense. Thanks for taking my call.
All right, thank you for your call, Will. We're going to keep moving on ahead. We have all the lines are full, so we want to get as many people on the air as possible. Moving on to David from Columbia, South Carolina, listening on St. Peter's Radio. David, go right ahead with your question.
Oh, yes. Thank you for taking my call. I had a question about the Old Testament writings that when they were given to the Jewish people from God, and were they protected by infallibility when interpreting Scripture? And if so, how did they get the prophecies about the coming Messiah wrong? And why didn't they recognize Jesus as the Messiah when he walked among them?
That's a great question, David. And no, there was no magisterium as we have in the Catholic Church. There was not a magisterium in Judaism, you know, before the time of Christ. This is something that Jesus gave us. Jesus appointed Peter as the head of the apostles. He became what today we call the Pope. He was the first one of a line of now 260-some popes. And the bishops, in communion with him, we recognize this as the teaching office of the church. We call that the magisterium. This is something that was divinely put into place by Christ. And this is not something that we see in the Old Testament. We do see, you know, we see the Pharisees, we see the Sadducees, and we have the Sanhedrin, and there are lawgivers and interpreters of the Jewish the Old Testament, but there was not a magisterium in place as there is now, as Christ gave us in the Catholic Church. So it's not surprising, really, to find that even at the time of Jesus, we have the Sadducees and the Pharisees and this really division among Judaism, even in the first century. Those Jews who recognized Jesus recognized him because of the teaching that they heard from him and from his disciples, from in later going down the road, from the magisterium of the church. You know, Peter and the apostles preaching, and Peter and the apostles appointing others as bishops and priests in the churches that they would establish. And this this magisterium is something that's new with Jesus' church, with Christianity, distinct from what there was in Judaism. Okay, David?
Oh, that's a perfect answer. That's what I was looking for. You really cleared up the confusion. Thank you.
Okay. All right, David. Thank you so much for your call. We'll go ahead and go to our final break. And right after the break, we'll pick it up with some more questions and some more answers on Catholic Answers Live.
Hang on. Catholic Answers Live will return in a moment.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects homebuyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Do you love sharing the gospel and want to learn to be more effective? Join the St. Paul Street Evangelization Online School of Evangelization. You will learn to build bridges of trust and make disciples by befriending strangers, proclaiming the gospel, inviting people to the church, and praying with others. We'll ask for a pledge of financial support, but if you are unable to give, we'll give you a membership at no cost. Find out more and get involved today at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
You know, we talk story with each of our very unique guests for the whole hour, so that you can go deep with us as you yourself pursue your own story of heroic virtue and as you pursue intimacy with God.
The Bear Wozniak Adventure, Saturday night, 6 Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Catholic Answers Live. open forum with Jim Blackburn. Jim, as I was telling you earlier, you were actually an apologist here at Catholic Answers when I first started listening. And I think as a young man, one thing that I struggled a bit with was scrupulosity. And I didn't know what it was. I didn't actually know the term until later. So can you maybe just talk a little bit about that, scrupulosity, and kind of how to...
Sure. Yeah, scrupulosity is something we want to stay away from because it recognizes sin where there is no sin. The word itself, someone who scruples, someone who you might think when we use the word scruples, someone who has scruples can have a good connotation to it because it's someone who cares about what he does, that what he does is right and doesn't want to do what's wrong. But scrupulosity is a gross exaggeration of that. And it sees sin where there is no sin. And this is something that psychologically today in psychology, if you want to go there, is associated with OCD, obsessive compulsion disorder. Where someone is just obsessed with every action, everything that they do in such a way that he always believes he's sinning, or he believes that sometimes when he does something and it's not a sin, he thinks that it is a sin. And that can just be turmoil for a person who suffers from this. A good way to overcome it is to recognize, as the Church teaches in the Catechism, that mortal sin is what separates us from God. So while we need to be cautious of venial sin and we want to stay away from venial sin, don't scruple too much about those. Let's look at what the mortal sins are and really make sure we're staying away from those. And mortal sins are sins that are grave matter, meaning that it's something that separates us from friendship with God. But for it to be a mortal sin, we must commit this grave matter, this grave act, knowing how serious it is and freely choosing it. It's a personal choice that we're choosing to do this. So you cannot commit a mortal sin without knowing it and willing it, and knowing how serious the sin is and still freely choosing it. That can be helpful for someone who suffers from scrupulosity because oftentimes a scrupulous person will say, well, I didn't mean to do this, but I think I sinned. Or is this a serious sin or is it not as serious as enough to be a grave sin? Well, if you don't know, if you don't have that knowledge, then it's not, you're not going to be committing a mortal sin. You cannot commit a mortal sin without knowing it and willing it. So there are some great helps out there. Scrupulous Anonymous on the internet is a great resource. Father Thomas Santa, I believe, is who founded that, and I believe still there. There are books on scrupulosity, but I find that when we have people contact us at Catholic Questions sometimes with who are scrupulous, and we have to explain to them that we are not spiritual directors. We're here from an apologetics perspective. We want to help people understand the faith, explain it, and defend it from those who would challenge it. So if someone's calling us or contacting us and saying, you know, did I sin here? Should I go to confession? These kinds of things, we refer them to spiritual directors. And I would encourage anyone who thinks he might suffer from scrupulosity to get in touch with a spiritual director. It could be your confessor. It doesn't have to be, though, a confessor. It doesn't have to be an ordained priest. It can be, just check with your local parish and find out if there are spiritual directors locally who can help you. Make an appointment, sit down, and then trust what your spiritual director tells you. And a while of trusting this and building this confidence, a person can overcome scrupulosity. So that was a great question. I know that it's not an uncommon matter, and it's a serious matter that a lot of people suffer from. Oh, yeah. And I struggle to help them. I'm not a spiritual director, but I know when they contact us at Catholic Questions that they need help. And so we just try to refer anyone who suffers from scrupulosity to those experts who can help them with spiritual direction.
Great. Yeah, I'm glad you shared those resources. All right, let's move on. Let's go to Giuseppe calling from Connecticut, listening on Catholic.com. Giuseppe, go right ahead with your question.
Hi, how are you doing?
Doing well. How are you?
All right. So my question was, so following the Battle of Lepanto, Pope Pius V instituted the Feast of Our Lady of Victory. And then subsequently, in many following years, many following popes, it was changed to Our Lady of the Rosary. Now, my question is, would asking the intercession of Our Lady of Victory be all right? Or because the popes have changed the feast to Our Lady of the Rosary, are we only able to ask Our Lady's intercession under that title?
Okay. Well, I would ask you this. When you're asking for Our Lady of Victory's intercession, and that's just a title, who are you asking for intercession?
Well, we're asking Our Lady.
Mary.
I mean, so everybody's...
Mary, my mother and heaven,
depending
right?
on her title, you know, what you're asking for her intercession, you know, there's Our Lady of Sorrows, and there's specific devotions for that, so you would ask for certain things depending on that, and Our
sure.
Lady of Perpetual Help has certain things that you're, whatever you're struggling with or whatever you want help with, you ask depending on what her title is.
Okay. The title can help us focus on what it is we're asking for. But we have to keep in mind that all of these different titles for Mary are just that. And as long as who we're praying to, who we're asking to intercede for us is Mary, then, and we call her Our Lady of Victory or Our Lady of the Rosary or in any of the titles for Mary, then that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. Now, I'm talking about on a personal level. Now, at a parish level, or if there's a public type of devotion going on, I don't know that the church may have suppressed the use of certain titles so that the church, the local parish or the local diocese, isn't to venerate a saint under a particular title. But on a personal level, you know, if we're our intention is to pray to Mary, that's who we're praying to, and we're using that title or a title that we've come up with on our own, that can be fine. Don't we talked about scrupulosity before? Don't scruple about this. Mary knows when you're asking for her intercession, and if you call her by Our Lady of Victory, it's not going to somehow reduce the effectiveness of your prayers or the effectiveness of her prayers. But again, Giuseppe, I'm talking on a personal level, so that's perfectly fine.
All right. Thank you, Giuseppe, for that question. We're going to move on because we have plenty of callers still on the line that we want to get to. So moving on to Bo, calling from Oklahoma, listening on 97.3 FM. Bo, go right ahead with your question.
Hello. So my question is about Paedo Communion. And it's why does the Roman Rite not practice it while the Byzantine Rite do? Like, why do they practice it rather than... I guess that's my question. Why does the Byzantine question practice it and the Roman Rite doesn't?
I'm sorry. Why does the Roman Rite practice what?
Oh, no. So why does the Byzantine Rite practice Paedo Communion and the Roman Rite doesn't?
Oh, okay. Well, they're two different traditions. In the Eastern Rite Catholic churches, the Byzantine Rite, we have when a child is baptized, the child receives actually three sacraments: baptism, confirmation, and Eucharist. Now, the reception of the Eucharist doesn't continue after that until the child reaches the age of reason and then discerns, understands what he's receiving, and then begins receiving again at that point. But why withhold graces that we can? I mean, I'm kind of more on the Eastern Orthodox side of this. No, I'm not saying either one is wrong, but they're just two different traditions. In the Roman Rite, infants are baptized, but that's the only sacrament that the child receives until he attains the use of reason, say around 7 years old. At that point, because he's capable of committing a mortal sin, he'll go to confession, and then he'll receive his first communion. And then later, as he learns more about the faith, he'll usually, in many dioceses, it's around early teens, the child will receive the sacrament of confirmation. There are advocates in the Roman Rite to begin having our children, our infants, at least baptized and confirmed as infants. Why withhold the grace of confirmation until the early teen years? It'd be wonderful to at least have access to that grace before that. So, Bo, was that does that answer your question? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, that's what I was talking about. Yeah, I was actually unaware that they didn't continue on with it. They just did, they just received the sacrament, or those three sacraments at the same time. I thought they continued on partaking of the Eucharist. So, but that answered my question. Yes, thank you.
Okay, great. I would mention that when we look at the gifts of the Holy Spirit, which are received at confirmation, many of those gifts are not something that an infant or a child younger than the age of reason is going to have access to. So that grace is not going to be effective until that child gets to an age where those graces, those gifts are really accessible to him. But still, the idea of having that grace available as soon as that child has the ability to receive that grace, I understand why some people advocate for that. But yes, reception of communion, even in the Byzantine Rite, is not something that continues after that first communion as an infant until the child reaches an age where he understands what it is.
Okay, yeah. Well, thank you so much.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks for that question. I know there's a lot of conversations in regards to, especially in the Western Rite, the Roman Rite, of restored order for the sacraments, right? Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little bit about that? Kind of, do you know a little bit of the history? Do you know when that changed and kind of a little bit of the advocacy for the restored order?
Well, I certainly know about the advocacy for it. I know that there are, I mean, I don't know a particular organization that advocates for it, but I know many people who advocate for it. In fact, I myself have advocated not just for that, but for more preparation, just like we prepare our children for the sacrament of first confession and then his first communion. We want to make sure the child understands he's receiving sacrament and what that sacrament means and recognizes the real presence and in the Eucharist and the need for contrition in confession and these actually being forgiven for his sins. Confirmation programs are often 2 years where the children will be taught about the gifts of the Holy Spirit and get them thinking about how these graces can become effective in their lives and such. But then I think we kind of drop the ball because what do most people go on to do after that? Well, some will become enter holy orders, but most go on to marriage. Why don't we bring in sacramental preparation for marriage while they're still children, say maybe in those later teen years, a couple of years of that, so we don't have so many failed marriages within the Catholic Church. Anyway, I don't know if that exactly addressed your question.
Yeah, no,
but
that's great. Yeah, perfect timing too, as you hear the music, we're coming to the end of the show. So Jim Blackburn, thank you so much for taking this time and answering these Catholic questions to these Catholic and giving some Catholic answers. So
thanks for having me. God bless you.
Yeah, and remind us the website that you're on.
CatholicQuestions.com.
All right. Thank you very much. And Jason, Joshua, Chris, apologies. Give us a call back tomorrow. We do have open forum with Joe the first hour. And second hour, we have ethics with Father Ted Poholchek. You have been listening to Catholic Answers Live, and we'll catch you tomorrow.